watching a woman go through the rebirth process of reclaiming her power and the goddess archetype within her and her sovereignty, it is one of the most powerful things I've ever seen. It truly is just a magnificent honor to be able to witness this and hold space for women and guide women through this. But I think it's really crucially important that women are able to connect to some type of archetype or even just a sense of their own wholeness, which is really difficult in this culture.
Welcome to Loving the F. I'm Melissa Allison, and this is the podcast that looks at the forbidden and says, hey, baby. I talk to a new guest each week and examine the female, finances, friends, family, fitness, and all the other F words. So join me, especially if it's forbidden.
Thank you so much for joining us for this week's conversation of Loving the F, the podcast that redefines the forbidden. I am thrilled, honored, humbled, and excited to have this guest, Amy Bammel Wilding. If you have not heard of her, she is an author. She is a sacred woman. I'm getting it wrong, but we're just going with it. She is a wise woman, wild woman, circle facilitator. Yes. And she, I learned about you, Amy, through your book, Wild and Wise. It's a book of meditations and about women and the goddess. And I listen to it usually late at night. It is so soothing, so comforting, so healing. And your voice, you narrate it. Obviously, I have the audio version.
Right.
It's in print if you like to read. But yeah, it is so beautiful. What? First off, welcome.
And thank second, you. Happy to be here.
What was your inspiration for this?
Well, for the book, I've been the creative director of Red Tent Louisville, which is a community for women and girls in the Louisville area. And I've been leading women's circles for over a decade. And so for each circle, I would think about a healing journey that I wanted to facilitate for the women in attendance. And the best way for me to do that was to create my own meditation. So over the course of many, many years, many, many circles, I would write a meditation for each circle. And the process for the women involved was so beautiful in the actual circle experience. But what happened many times afterwards was that women would say, I really need to continue doing work with this particular meditation. So can you send it to me? Can you email it to me? And so I did that for quite a long time. And as the years went on, several people kind of planted the seed, like, this should be its own book. You should write a book about this. You should contain all of these meditations in some way. And I was really resistant at first because I consider these meditations the medicine that I am sharing with the world. So it felt very personal for me. Like, I've created this baby, and people were saying, send your baby out into the world. I was like, I don't know if I'm ready for that yet. But what over the course of maybe a year or year and a half, what I came to realize was that these meditations aren't helping somebody just piling up on my computer, and that I could have a much farther reach in creating the change in the world that I wish to see if I'm opening up these meditations to women all over the world. So I made the decision. It felt very much like jumping off a cliff to me because I couldn't foresee where they would end up and how they would be used. And but I had to really take a leap of faith and let go of a sense of ownership over the meditations and realize that I have always felt that I'm a channel for this medicine. It doesn't come specifically from me. I feel it comes through me. And as it comes through me, it's filtered through my own experiences and my own life and my own perceptions. But this medicine is meant for the world in a much bigger way than just, you know, through my own person. So that was what inspired me to put them together as a collection. And as I did, I began to see that there were very specific themes. And that's why the book is divided into the sections that it is, the sacred feminine and the goddess and the wheel of the year, because that was the medicine that I felt was so needed in my community by the women and girls that sit in circle with me. So as I put it all together, I realized like this is the structure that is needed for this kind of work specifically, because this is just not really out there and available to women. And I wrote the book with circle leaders in mind. I wrote the book as a resource for women who are leading circles. But then I came to realize as well that this is needed by individual women who may not have access to a women's circle, or who are wanting to do this work on their own, or may need, like the audiobook, for example, just need a space and time in their day to reconnect with themselves and their truth and their authenticity and their power. So it was a natural extension to do the audiobook as well, because I really believe that the meditations can only be fully accessed if you're listening to them. It's a very different experience if you're reading them, because then your thinking mind is really engaged. The most powerful way to access that wisdom is to allow yourself to shift into relaxation and let your thinking mind be offline for a little while. So the audiobook was just, it was a necessary part of the completion of this project. So I'm always so happy to hear when women resonate with the message and find a place for it in their lives.
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't remember what year did you release the book? What year was
2017.
It? Mm-hmm. Okay. I must have gotten it right when you released it.
Yeah, I released it in October of 2017. So it's just had its 2-year birthday.
Yeah. Wow. So I feel like I've had it forever. It felt like such an integral part of me. It's like, I don't remember the first time. I don't remember anything. But what I do know is I remember, you know, obviously the way it makes me feel. I feel supported listening to it. It's so healing. The night that it's January still. I was going to say earlier this year, but I guess it was December or something like that when I reached out to you finally. But yeah, I woke up in the middle of the night and I was going through a really difficult time. And I'm like, listen to Wild and Wise. And I put it on. And I just like, wherever it is, that's where I'm going to start listening. And
yeah,
exactly what I needed to hear. And I just started crying. And it's just so powerful on so many different levels, whether I listen to it as I'm driving consecutively or, you know, one meditation after the other, or if I just random it, something in there. And I feel like it has supported me in my own work, you know, not just as a woman, but being in alignment and integrity and collectively as a community of women, you know.
Yeah.
So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. That's just so nourishing for me to hear what a role I get to play in women's lives. I mean, that's really, it's such an honor for me to be trusted to be a part of women's journey. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, well, absolutely. So you mentioned that what the changes you wanted to see in the world. What is that? Can you talk about that?
Oh, very specifically, I'm all about dismantling patriarchy. That is what I'm all about. And I don't even use the term smashing patriarchy, because I think that is just a little bit too much hyperbole and it's not very realistic. Patriarchy is going to have to be disrupted and dismantled from the inside out. And that is the exact work that I do in the world with not only women, but I work very closely with girls and their mothers. And I'm also raising a son, and I'm going to begin a mother-son circle based on the book The Hero's Heart by Malia Keaton Digby. That's going to start in the fall. I am really specifically attuned to the messages that people absorb and internalize as part of a patriarchal culture. And so my work is going in individually and collectively and showing people the ways that these messages have disrupted us as whole humans. And I'm really all about not only the process of unlearning, which has to happen with women, but inoculating girls and boys against the messages of patriarchy that really serve to amputate us emotionally and constrain us and confine us So that is the work that I very intentionally do with everybody that I come in contact with. And a lot of work that I do is teaching women and girls about their menstrual cycle. And so people, I think, assume that I have this fascination with menstruation or blood or periods, but that's not it. The work that I do around menstruation and cycles and menarche and perimenopause and menopause is because this is probably the primary point of contact between women and patriarchy is our bodies. And we are very systematically disconnected from our own power because of the shame that's associated with menstruation. So I do a lot of work around that, not because I am particularly obsessed with menstruation, but because there's such a lack of power and knowledge in girls and women, and then by extension in boys and men. So that is a huge part of the work that I do, is allowing women to reclaim the power that's associated with cycle literacy and body sovereignty. In addition to the sacred feminine work that I do and the goddess archetype work that I do, I'm also really intent on allowing women to reclaim power that I believe is our birthright and that we've lost.
Right.
Over so many years of not being part of community. Women need women. That's the bottom line. In every circle that I sit in with women, what I hear is a hunger to be able to talk about things related to our female experience.
I love the work of Dr. Christiane Northrup.
Yes.
She talks about our menstrual cycles, menopause, you know, that those are very powerful times. They're not to be shame, that's when you're most intuitive and creative, when it's sacred time to slow down and to tune in. But, you know, I'm in a very patriarchal community. I live in Salt Lake City. It's kind of the hub of the LDS church, the Latter-day Saints. And so when you say dismantle patriarchy, that people here, I can imagine, would take that as an attack. You know, that it would be this destructive thing. When you say dismantle patriarchy, what are you speaking about exactly?
Yes, I'm attacking. Yeah.
Okay. And how is it harmful to even men? Because I think that's like, well, it's a man's thing. So how could it be hurting them?
Well, patriarchy isn't about men. It's a social structure that rewards particular things. So it happens to reward things like domination, and hypermasculinity is one of these things that is considered the ultimate expression of manhood. So you have to be really strong and really dominant and cut off your emotions. So this is incredibly damaging to boys and men, because what it says to them is you're only acceptable if you are exhibiting power or dominance over something else. And what happens to be dominated in all cases is anything representative of the feminine. So that could be sensitivity, nurturing, creativity, artisticness, affection between boys and men, even to extending to our earth. We perceive the earth as feminine, and I fully believe that because of patriarchal society, we treat the earth like a woman. You know, we treat the earth as though she is to be dominated and raped and taken under control and seized. So there's so many ways that this affects boys and men as well, because what it necessitates in them is dominating internally their own, anything that could be perceived as feminine, which isn't necessarily feminine, but it's just human. You know, we all have sensitivity, we all have kindness, we all have affection, we have needs for closeness and intimacy, and those things are really amputated in boys and men. So what we grow up seeing is that they do not have a complete sense of self, and that their sense of identity really comes from how powerful they can appear.
When I think about, because I have three sons, and I started a workshop for Waking Aphrodite. And one of the things I felt like I needed to make clear, even in my conversations with other women during my podcast interviews, when it's exciting to talk about female and empowerment and the changes that are happening, how women are coming together, it's a wonderful, exciting thing. But I also want to make sure, and we kind of touched on this before in a conversation about, it's not at the exclusion of men. It is not to harm or to diminish men. But yeah, I think, you know, Brené Brown specifically, she shares one man coming up to her. He had bought her books for his wife and daughters. And he said, they would rather see me die on my horse than break down in tears.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a really important point, because women internalize and pass on patriarchy just as much as men.
Yes.
And I do see that more in cultures that are associated with religion. There is a huge pressure on women to continue to perpetuate patriarchy, because they only get approval if they continue to do that. If they teach their daughters and their sons, you must adhere to these guidelines and you must adhere to these guidelines, then they get branded a good girl. So there, you know, there's a lot of good girl mentality within patriarchy, and that is one of the most profound ways that it proliferates, is because it's perpetuated by women upon other women and girls and boys. So really everybody is affected by this. I know it's, you know, the work that I do with women and girls isn't necessarily to the exclusion of men, but because women and girls need a very safe space,
yes,
in order to do the work that is required in order to kind of break the chains of patriarchy. We cannot do it under the male gaze, obviously. So what I create is something that most women have never experienced in their lives, which is a safe place to be completely truthful and authentic, but it's also a safe place to hear the stories of other women. And generally, that can be even more magic and healing for women, because we kind of walk around this world disconnected from a sense of community. And so a lot of our experiences feel like we're the only one thinking this, we're the only one feeling this, we're the only one doing this, when in reality, there's so many universal thoughts and feelings and experiences that help us heal our own journey. But we don't know that unless we're listening to the stories of other women.
Right.
And we just really can't do that safely in the presence of men. It's just, you know, it's just the way it is.
You know, from the time I was little, I always felt this powerful thing inside of me. I didn't know what it was, but it scared me, you know. And sometimes it came up when I was angry. Sometimes it came up when I was, you know, feeling powerful and stuff. But I shut it away forever. And not until a few years ago, when I was in a shelter with my children, we were in a shelter for 7 weeks, did I, you know, with the therapist there, I asked her, I said, I feel like I'm supposed to, this isn't the life I'm supposed to be, like, it's supposed to be bigger, it's supposed mm-hmm. to be more, it's supposed to be all these things. And I said, I feel like she's this giant, but if I let her take over, like, am I crazy? Like, is this, you know, she was like, she says, I don't know, only you can answer that. So my question for you is, do all of us have this? I mean, I don't even know what to call it. I call her Aphrodite now, and that's how the evolution of this project that I'm working on now. But yeah, it's like, it's this sacred, powerful thing that we are not encouraged to embrace.
Oh no, not at all. And in fact, I mean, even I'm 46 years old, and I still grapple with the ways in my own life that I was told to stay small and quiet. I am a really fucking loud person, and that's how I've always been.
Yeah.
But I was always given the message that it was too much, like too much, too loud, too this, too that. And so I still do the work to undo those messages, even now at this point in my life. But I do, coming back to your question specifically, one of the reasons that I chose very intentionally to work with women with goddess archetypes, which this began, my work with goddess archetypes began with my own daughter when she was 7 years old. Mm-hmm. And a friend and I created a yoga class for girls called Goddess Girls Yoga, because I was like, I want to give my daughter more to emulate than what we see in our culture. So we created this, and that was probably around the time that I was introduced to the work of Jean Shinoda Bolen, who wrote the book Goddesses in Every Woman. And that's exactly what she says, is we all contain or manifest these goddess archetypes. They're within us, and they're transmitted culturally. So we have the ability to tap into that sovereignty, that power, but it is so constrained by the culture that we live in. And I think watching a woman go through the rebirth process of reclaiming her power and the goddess archetype within her and her sovereignty it is one of the most powerful things I've ever seen. And I am in the position of being able to witness that over and over again, which I feel is one of the most important roles in my life, is I midwife these rebirths. And it truly is just a magnificent honor to be able to witness this and hold space for women and guide women through this. But I think it's really crucially important that women are able to connect to some type of archetype, or even just a sense of their own wholeness, which is really difficult in this culture. And that is why we need archetypes, in my opinion, is because they do allow us to connect to an idea that is representative of what we may be feeling inside. So, but it's interesting because it's such a journey that women go through. It's almost like the heroine's journey. You know, you have to go through all of these phases, and it isn't until typically around midlife that women begin to have a desperate need to reclaim these parts of themselves.
Yeah.
And I would like to see in our culture that we don't have to go through a reclaiming process, that we get to claim that from the beginning.
You know, that is like you've touched on so many buttons for me, because one of the things I remember when I was telling my daughter, who she's 19 now, but I think she was like 16 at the time. And she's like, "You chose Aphrodite, Mom? Do you know how, like, she is horrible. You know all the horrible things she did and stuff?" And I'm like, "Oh my gosh." And she's telling me all these horrible things. And I thought, do I need to find a new goddess? Or archetype and stuff? And then I thought, no, I love her flaws. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that this goddess is flawed. She loves beauty. She loves love. She wants it for everybody, but she's flawed, which means yeah. I get to be flawed.
Yes.
I get to embrace all of that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, last year my whole life imploded, but I never felt more in alignment. And it's exactly what you were talking about, this rebirthing process of owning it and reclaiming it, you know, and letting go of the fear. It's like, whatever happens, happens, you know?
That's right. Yeah. I think women, I mean, men too, I can't speak to the experience of men because I'm not a man, but right. What I do know is that the fear of judgment shapes so much of what we do as women. And that as we get to this midlife point and perimenopause, I think that is what is so profound about that time, is we get to the point where we're like, I don't care what other people think. I really don't care what you think or what culture thinks. I know what is mine to reclaim. And that is the really powerful catalyst that begins to happen for women, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, for myself, it's been very liberating, you know, and like you said, you have to continue. The work isn't done. It's not like you can check the box and say done and never have to address it again. There is
that. Right. Wouldn't that be great?
Yes, that will. What would happen if that happened? But, it's a constant work. Oh, and the other thing too was, you know, I thought when I started this time last year, it was like 2019 was going to be my reinvention. I called it my Madonna / Cher level reinvention. But the thing that I realized, it's not a reinvention, it's a remembering, you know?
Oh God. Yes. Yes. Yes, it is. That's absolutely right. And it's so interesting to hear stories of women at this point. What they say is, I feel like I'm a girl again. I feel like I'm, you know, in my preteen years where I really know what I want and what brings me pleasure, and I'm not afraid to say what I want. And so it's like a returning almost to a sense of freedom that was very slowly but very methodically taken away from us. And puberty is typically when that begins to happen. Yeah. And then as we, you know, we live those years of conformity and we do all the things that we're supposed to do, and we get to this point where we realize we're like fucking dead inside. Yeah. And I think that is, that's a really crucial point for women when they start to say, I just can't live like this anymore.
That's interesting you touch on losing things at puberty, that it begins. I very distinctly, the first thing that I lost going through puberty was my father's affection. You know, mm-hmm. It went from sitting on his lap, him rocking, singing to me, playing with me, teasing me, to this very hands-off type of thing. And that, as a young girl going through that, you don't realize what's happening. It's like, what did I do? What's wrong? So how do you address that for women who have gone through that, or for the young girls who are in the process of that?
What we talk about a lot is the sexualization of young women, and sometimes young women are girls, you know. Girls begin to go through puberty at like 10, 11, 12 years old now, and they are subject to sexualization that is very unfamiliar, but of course uncomfortable. And I think that that ripples out to everyone in that person's environment, that child's environment. And I really do think that it is one of the few ways that men can relate to women is sexually, as sexual objects. So I have heard stories from women about their husbands and their relationships with their daughters. And it's heartbreaking to hear the things that fathers do and say to their daughters. I mean, it almost brings me to tears right now, but it also makes me enraged.
Yeah.
But the way that we change that narrative for our girls is by modeling acceptance of what they're going through, but also modeling for them that we are holding that safe space for them. So a lot of times girls have to hear their mothers having conversations with their fathers about menstrual blood. It's not gross, you know, like we're not going to continue this shame cycle and pass on this legacy to our own daughters. It stops right here. And it stops not only with us as mothers, but with the fathers as well. So I've seen women do a lot of really brave work within their relationships to maintain an environment of safety for their children. And that is really what it comes down to. It comes down to things like our four-year-old son seeing menstrual blood and us just being open and authentic and real about it instead of continuing to cloak everything in shame and taboo. That's how it gets perpetuated. I mean, I'm raising a boy who's going to someday probably be someone's husband and probably be someone's father. So my work isn't just with women and girls. It is with the boys and the men too, because the whole entire story has to be changed from every point of view.
You know, that series, which I love this series, it's on Amazon, but The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Oh gosh, yeah, one of my favorites.
There are so many examples of how women hide things, you know, that they're not discussed, you know, and the expectations of appearance and conduct and all these other things. It's like, yeah.
Right, that story took place 70 years ago, and yet we're still doing the same shit. And we're still, the expectations are still the same. The taboo is still the same. I recognize the points that they made in the show about, oh my gosh, can you believe this is how women were treated, this is how we talk. But it's like, we are not that far away from it yet. It's still happening. Especially like you mentioned, in communities that are more religious tend to be much more shame and taboo based parts of the country where people are less religious and more educated. I mean, I live in Louisville. It's the same here. There's just little pockets, but in general, I live in the South. It's a lot of the same here.
It's a lot of work ahead, you know, but it's happening. That's the exciting thing, is it is happening, whereas it wasn't before.
Yeah, I really vacillate back and forth between feeling like this is the best time to be alive. I'm so happy I get to be here doing this work and witnessing what's happening, to other days when I'm like, I'm hopeless. What are we gonna do?
Yeah.
And one of the workshops that I frequently give is called Find Your Medicine and Use It. And I created the workshop in response to Trump being elected. Because everyone was in such
a part of that.
And we were like, what the hell are we going to do? So I created this workshop sort of based on the premise of Stephen Covey's The 7 Habits. Okay, we all know what that is. And one of the things that he talks about in the book that really stuck with me is that we have what he called our circle of concern and our circle of influence, right? So our circle of concern is everything that we might be worried about in the world or in our home or in our community. And our circle of influence is the things we can literally affect. And I walk around my life with my sphere of concern this big all the time. And my sphere of influence may be like this big, but I just have to keep returning my focus to what I can do, what I individually can do to contribute to dismantling and changing the narrative for, I always say for women and girls, but I mean, for men and boys too.
Because, you know, we cohabitate.
Yeah.
Know? And yeah. It's like I said at the show, we all have male and female inside of us. So when one of us hurts, we all hurt, you know, it doesn't matter what your sexuality is. We share this planet, just like we share it with the animals, the plants, you know, the ocean. Yeah. And so we have a responsibility to each other. In my mind, those are my thoughts and feelings. Yeah. And it's, so I think the work is very important. And like you, I'm not a man, so I can't speak to the male experience, but I do have sons and I have a father and I have a brother and I've watched them move their life.
Yeah.
And it is difficult, you know, to be a man as well.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the patriarchy comes with its own set of restraints for every member of human culture. So, and we all experience those in different ways. And that's, to me, healing is going to have to come. I almost have shifted in my thinking. I used to say, when women heal, the world heals. And that's definitely true. But now I'm like, oh God, the men have to heal. They've got to heal.
Yeah.
Or nothing's going to ever change.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll be in opposition still.
Yes.
So what does that look like when things are healed? What does that look like? How do we know?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's something that I remember as a girl thinking, here's how the world should be.
Oh, I've had this thought.
Here's what it would look like.
Yeah.
Let me preface that answer by saying that I believe if you could construct a social model that would be as detrimental as possible psychologically, physically, emotionally, and spiritually to humans, it would be what we're living in right now. Like this, I really feel that we are living in a setup that is so deeply unhealthy in every way to humans, that what I envision when you say, okay, what is it going to look like when it's healed, is a return to true community where we are living in close proximity to one another, because humans need community, and women especially. Women, okay, no, not women especially, men I know need community too.
Yes.
I'm going to speak about what I know women need community around, and specifically, like I mentioned earlier, hearing stories about things like menarche and sex and pregnancy and birth and breastfeeding and menstruation and perimenopause and menopause, all of those big life transitions need to be talked about in order for us to understand our own experiences. But beyond stories, what I see is that in this particular moment in our culture, there's such immense pressure on women to maintain the role as the primary caregiver in their families, but also be out in the world working and doing whatever job earning money that they are doing in that moment. But there's no system of support to help women get through that. So I see a lot of mothers that are going through emotional burnout, that are having complete mental breakdowns. And we've seen this rise in anxiety and depression, particularly in women. And I fundamentally believe that it is because we're not supported by community. The need for true community, and that when I envision a healthy world, what I am imagining is a true sense of proximal physical community where we're living close to people, we're living close in a multi-generational type situation, so that all of the pressure of child rearing isn't placed strictly upon the mothers, which, I mean, let's be honest, that is what's happening. Yes. I know, like, there are articles that are like, dads are doing more work now than ever. It's like, who cares? Like, great, okay, but they're still not doing as much as moms. Yes. The pressure that is being put on women is what is causing this huge epidemic of depression and anxiety in mothers. I think, you know, mothers are drowning right now, and there is not a lifeline. The only lifeline really is, can you afford psychiatric care? Can you afford a counselor? Yeah. Do you have access? Do you have time in your schedule to go to therapy? You know, that is the reality of the situation, and it's not accessible to most women, unfortunately. And the what I feel very, I just feel such a sense of loss around the fact that women are paying a lot of money to receive the type of support that comes inherently with community, which is someone else to have your eyes on your kids for an hour or so a day, or someone else to help you make food, or someone to be with you when your child needs something in the middle of the night. We are not really meant to be doing this alone, but we are. And this leads into the other area that I feel really passionate about, which is capitalism is destroying us. It's absolutely destroying us. And women and children feel the brunt of that because we are all about production and consumption. And that is just not a sustainable way to live as individuals, and it's not sustainable as a planet. So it would take an entire shift in paradigm of the way that we relate as humans to each other and to the planet in order for us to live in what could be called a healthy system. It begins with true community, you know, proximity to other people who can create a safety net for women and children. That's where it has to start.
You know, I got pregnant at 19. I wasn't married, and it scared me. So I went back to church. It's like, I'm gonna do everything right.
And, right. Oh, yeah. Yep.
And one of the things that the church had me do, I was put on probation, and I had to read this book called The Miracle of Forgiveness that was written by one of the leaders of the church. And in the book, it talks about, you know, it's better that you should die than to allow yourself to be raped. You know,
oh, stuff like God. This.
Yes. Yes. So I'm a young, hormonal, pregnant, scared 19-year-old girl reading this book, and I'm feeling
okay,
like...
Okay, didn't say, hey, boys, it's better to die than to rape a girl. Right. Of course
no. No, but I attribute this, and I didn't make this connection until recently, because after I had my baby, you know, I was looking at giving it up for adoption, but my father said, you know, we got you, you know, you don't need to do that. And so I kept the baby and went through postpartum depression, and the depression that, like, you could almost call it psychosis, because I kept not literally hearing voices, but these conversations were going on in my head. Of you've got to sacrifice your baby like Abraham is going to sacrifice Isaac. You have got to show God that you love him more than you love this baby. And I was too scared to tell anybody about that. But for the first few months of this experience of motherhood, I struggled in silence. It was painful. It was scary. I felt like I was letting God down. I was letting my baby down. And, you know, fortunately, I didn't do those things, but it makes me think of people like Andrea Yates, you know, in Texas. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but several years, decades ago, she had drowned her 5 babies, yes. I think, in the bathtub. Yep. And we are so quick to attack these women who have done these horrible, it's horrible, but you don't understand the mechanics of what goes on behind it. And it's like, it doesn't support the woman. It doesn't support the mother or the child, male or female.
Right. Right. That's absolutely right. Yeah. And I think that until we have a fundamental shift in our agreements with each other as humans, this legacy of depression, anxiety, abuse, and addiction is just going to go on and on, because this is not how humans are meant to live.
Yeah. Yeah, Utah is, I think, has the number one, at least it did a few years ago, number one state for prescription of antidepressants. And yeah, it's sad, but it is, you know, beautiful people, beautiful community and things like that, yeah. In our dysfunction,
You know, it's, well, it's interesting to me. I live just like a mile from one of those big mega churches, and I was passing it on my way back home this morning, and the entire parking lot was full. And, you know, I am very critical of the influence that patriarchal religion has on people. But I had this flash of insight that I've never had before as I was passing. And I was like, look at all those people going to church, going to this big building on Sunday morning. Like, the parking lot is full, and who knows, there's probably 1,000 spaces in that parking lot. And I was thinking, it's so interesting too, they can afford this building because people willingly give whatever, let's just say 10% of their income to the church. And that is what allows this particular church to thrive in the way that it does. But then I was like, but it does give people a sense of community. It does give people a sense of support. They have programs for children. And granted, I think they're all brainwashing, okay?
Yeah,
they're brainwashing.
Right.
But what the insight that I had was, oh, okay, so this structure is available to us in our society. It serves the role of community. They have singing, they have events, they have childcare, they have classes, they have all of these things that humans need. You know, we need community, we need a sense of support, we need a sense of purpose and well-being, we need to feel supported, and that is what church provides to a lot of people. It's just unfortunate that the brainwashing is the price that you pay to get that. So I was like, oh, wouldn't it be so amazing if there was just actual community with all of these things available to anyone? Like, church is available to anybody. And even, I don't really know the ins and outs, but probably counseling programs and programs for, you know, people who are financially struggling, all these things that community should be supporting. Like, so we know that it's possible, but is it possible to do that without the negative, which some people would not consider.
Well, the price tag.
I personally think it's very negative. The emotional and spiritual influence that is placed upon people who want to take part in that community.
Well, you know, I can speak from firsthand experience growing up in the church and having my ancestors helped form the LDS church, some of them. And so there's deep roots in my family connected with it. But I had heard before when I was active in the church, you know, you're being brainwashed. And it's like, I'm an intelligent person. You know, I have my own thoughts. I don't agree with everything. So I'm thinking, but after, it kind of reminds me of going through my divorce. I remember finally on the other side of my divorce, looking back, and it was as if I was coming out of a fog, you know?
Yeah.
Who was that person and how did that happen?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. Well, and I think it's kind of like a little bit like the frog boiling in the pot, you know, it's so incremental, and what we're willing to accept for a sense of belonging, I think, is very expansive. And that could be belonging in community, or it could be belonging in terms of your marriage or your relationship. It's interesting. I had circled, was it two nights ago? And one of the women was talking about how she is now going through, just like we were saying before, a reclamation of herself. And looking back, she said, what I recognize now is that there were just these tiny micro concessions where I betrayed myself in that moment.
Oh, yeah.
And looking back, I can see that pattern. But in the moment, obviously, I just thought I was being flexible or loving or whatever, because everybody has to compromise. But she said, I realize now I compromise parts of myself that you shouldn't ever have to compromise.
Yeah.
And for me, that's kind of how I feel about the church, is what you compromise is a sense of worthiness. Like, why are we signing up for this? Who is that? Especially women. That's, I just can't understand it. Even though some of my very dear, dear friends are Christian, I am just like, I get what the positive side is for you, but I can't understand how you can integrate that message of being inherently unworthy and just get on with your life like it's okay. So it perplexes me, but I did not grow up with religion. So I have a very different viewpoint, and I have always felt skeptical, I guess, of that particular arrangement.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, congratulations. I'm happy that you didn't grow up with it, because I don't see it. You know, people often, when they leave the LDS church, they become atheists. They're very angry. And I left the church, and I'm not angry per se, but you know, I'm just not religious, and I don't know what I am. I don't pretend to have the answers of the universe, you know, of time and everything else. I'm just this single human being trying to live the best life that I can in alignment with my highest self, and hoping to leave a better place than what I found.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I do think that's an experience that a lot of people, women particularly, find that they have a sense of spirituality.
Yeah.
And it is not related to religion. And in fact, sometimes it's in direct opposition to the message that we hear all around us from religion. But that sense of spirituality, I think, is very grounding, and it's needed in a lot of cases for women to have something to hold on to, because we are so excluded from the spiritual aspect of a monotheistic religion. And that is why and how I think a lot of women are raised to believe that we're inherently unworthy of love and acceptance. And you can see the ramifications of that in every woman's life.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like I was telling someone yesterday that, you know, when I was a member of the church, that I didn't get to be a good person just because I was a good person, because I had quotas I had to meet as a visiting teacher, as a member of the church, you know. And so it's like, what is my motivation? Am I doing this because this is what I would do if I didn't have the, and it takes away it, or diminished my experience. And so it's like, I don't want to do something because of pressure outside of there, you know, because expectations of other people, and this is how it has to be done.
Yeah,
I get to do this my way. I get to do it because I'm a good person, not because this is the pressure that this community is putting on me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think that's true not only of religious community, but just being a part of, you know, Western culture in itself too. Those expectations are very rigid on not only women, but men as well. And the idea of intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation, I think, is just, it's a fundamental question in human nature. Do you want to motivate somebody by dangling a carrot or by making them fear? And that, to me, that's what religion is all about. It's all fear-based. That's all it is. We can trust that people will probably do the right thing, whether they have that fear-based indoctrination behind them or not.
Yeah.
But it's about control.
So I don't know if you have an answer to this, but
I probably don't.
But when, not if, but when we are healed, when that happens, when we become that community, then what's next? What's the work after that?
Interesting. I think that what I've been thinking a lot about lately is how specifically capitalism and poverty prevent people from sharing their gifts and contributions to the world. And I was just having a conversation about this with my partner the other day. And it was a great conversation. So I think that that's the next step, is that we get to experience a life of making meaningful contributions to community. Like I said, I think that's what it all comes back down to. And if we're not in a position to be trying to meet our most basic needs 24 hours a day, then we have the space and the time and the energetic resources to cultivate our own gifts so that we can then return those to the community. And I think, you know, when I think of utopia, that's sort of the ideal for me, is that the basic fundamental needs are met somehow, and that people are free to cultivate and share their gifts and their contribution with their community. That to me seems like, yeah, we've reached the apex when we've gotten there.
You know, I don't know when it'll happen.
But I don't know either, but I mean, I tell my 14 and 10-year-old, if I were you, I don't know if I'd be having kids because we might not be making it after 30 years from now. So I don't know if this iteration of humanity is going to make it to the apex.
Yeah. You know, I just have to believe, you know, I'm a bit of an optimist. And so I hear that often. And especially given the current political climate. But we have been in much worse places, you know.
You're so right. I do have to remind myself of that.
Yeah. And we will rise. We will, because it's kind of like, you know, within ourselves, we have the light and the dark, the shadow and parts of us and stuff. We have that in our life experience as well. There are those dark times, and they help to, I believe personally, help us to evolve and to grow as human beings. Yeah. Because if we always had the light, pretty soon, you know, we become stagnant. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do
like
think
the mulching of the soil.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And well, that's life. And that cycle of death and rebirth and death and rebirth is necessary. Yeah. We go through that so many times as humans. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the book that I'm working on now is all about the journey of perimenopause. So currently I am requesting submissions and contributions from women who have either gone through perimenopause and menopause and would like to share their story, or women who are currently going through perimenopause and want to share their experiences. Like I mentioned earlier, knowing that we are not alone in our experience is probably the most powerful way that we can heal and reinvent ourselves and rebirth ourselves as women. So if you'd like to find out more about that, you can visit my website, which is redtentlouisville.com.
I'm 55 years old. I haven't been through menopause yet, and I don't know how to tell if I've been through menopause.
Okay, well, you and everybody else.
So that's a common problem.
Okay, well, good. Then you're going to need to make a contribution to my book so that your voice
I'll do it.
That's an important part of it as well. So when women want to contribute, what they'll do is reach out to me. And what I have set up right now is a Google form, which is kind of set up like a survey. There are questions that you can answer. So it's almost like writing prompts are provided for you.
Sure.
And I read each contribution and we'll be deciding within the next month or so which of those will make it into the book. But it's going to be a really amazing project. And my hope is that, like with Wild and Wise, it will serve so many women who feel like they do not have an anchor through this process at all. We want to create so much more visibility and conversation around this topic, because it is something that, like many other things related to women and menstruation, is just not talked about.
Right.
Even with medical providers, it's shocking to me the stories that I'm hearing about women who are so obviously experiencing perimenopause, but they're not even, it's not addressed by their care provider. So we need to do a lot more to provide support for women through this rite of passage as well.
So, you know, I have a question for you regarding female issues, since we've been talking about it the whole time.
Yeah.
But physical, hormonal is, you know, I had, I can't remember what they call it. When you have very heavy periods, it's like it would shut me down for a couple of days. I couldn't go out or anything because I was bleeding so much. And so I had a doctor who, I love him. He was amazing. He still is, I'm sure, but he's not my doctor anymore. He said, you can have a hysterectomy or an ablation, or we can do an IUD.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And so I had pressure, like so many women are saying, oh, just get the hysterectomy. It is so liberating. It's, I don't even miss it. And then other women are saying, oh, just get the ablation I'm very conservative when it comes to my health and this body, because I only get one. So I'm like, what can I do and what can I reverse? So I opted for the IUD. There is a tiny bit of hormone in it, but it worked for me. It was wonderful. And I know we're all different and stuff, but the thing that I have about, you know, we have our tonsils removed. We have an appendix, you know, sometimes things happen and there's nothing we can do about it. But I think some people are so cavalier And it's like, why would I take out my uterus? You know, it just feels like,
Well, that's really common. And the issue is that what you're experiencing, like flooding is one word for what you were experiencing, is a common symptom. It's a common experience of perimenopause because of the hormonal shifts that we experience. Mm-hmm. And that's medical Western culture's answer to everything is just cut that shit out, chop it out. Why even deal with it? Rather than dealing with women on a holistic level and saying, okay, so this is an indication that this is what's happening with your hormones. And here are your choices that address that hormonal shift. Yeah. Not take out your whole entire uterus, because that doesn't end the process of menopause in and of itself. And when you do go that route, you still experience the process of menopause, but it's just in a much more severe and acute way.
Right.
So it's not really like you're not avoiding the experience itself. It's just you're taking a different road to getting to the same place. And it's really harmful in our culture, the way that women are treated by the medical establishment, which is that we're typically not listened to, not believed. Most people don't understand what is related to perimenopause and menopause, not to mention a lot of the other things that women deal with around menstruation, or even just, you know, how women have predominantly more autoimmune disorder issues. This all comes into play because women are just not listened to and not believed and not cared for by the Western medical model, which is very male-oriented, male-dominated. And I think that is why we experience what we experience when the truth of the matter is there are so many ways that we can care for our bodies and our cycle as we go through this experience. But we don't know that because we're not hearing the stories from anybody.
Well, so what are some of those ways that we can holistically address those issues?
There's a lot of herbal support that women can utilize. There's a lot of actual physical support in terms of my abdominal massage and that sort of thing. There are lifestyle changes that we can adopt, and there are dietary changes that can be made. Some women find it really helpful to go on bioidentical hormones that don't work. They're not the answer for everybody, but they are the answer for some people. But that's, the point is that we are never given those options. We're not having those conversations with their care providers because either, number one, women are telling them that I'm experiencing this, this, and that. And they're like, well, sounds like you're depressed. Let me put you on some antidepressants. Or two, why don't we just take out your uterus? So those are the two main ways that our medical model right now addresses the symptoms of perimenopause. Is like, it's not even happening, so you must be literally going crazy. Or two, your uterus is the problem, let's take it out.
So when you release this book, is it going to contain resources for women to seek out?
Absolutely, yeah. It's going to be comprehensive in that it's going to discuss the physical, what is actually happening hormonally. So you can look and say, okay, I'm experiencing flooding menstruation, so that means this, or I'm experiencing hot flashes, and that means this. But it's also going to discuss the emotional and spiritual journey associated with perimenopause. And then there's going to be resources about how to get more information, but there's also going to be a section on how to create ceremony around this, because for a lot of women it is, and it can be, a very positive and empowering experience. It is a rite of passage, and if we allow women to return to focusing on that, it can really create a very meaningful journey for them.
I find in my consultations I am encouraging women more and more, and I'm like, I don't know where this is coming from, but to create ritual or ceremony their life.
It's simple, so important.
And it just, growing up in a religious thing, when you hear rituals and stuff, it's like, oh, that's evil. But
that's
no.
Exactly right. Yeah.
It's like, making a cup of tea in a beautiful cup and sitting by the window and watching nature or whatever, or listening to music, or, a ritual of taking a long bath and then using a special lotion afterwards. Those are rituals that support us, and add value to our own mind.
And actually the word ritual, some people believe that the root RTU was related to the marking of menstruation.
Oh.
And that's where the root of that word came from. Yeah.
Well, there you go. It all comes back.
It all comes back. Yeah.
That's wonderful. I have loved talking. When you release your other book, when it's published, we have to have another conversation.
Oh, yeah, let's do it.
We could go on. I think we're starting another cycle of a conversation here.
Yes. Yeah, we'll come back around to it.
Yeah, I mean, it is pertinent. It is something that we all as women, you know, go through and experience. And
yes. Yeah. And we haven't even talked about the work that I do with girls around ritual for menarche. That's my book after this book.
Oh my gosh. Well, and I want to hear more about the yoga that you do for girls, you know, and archetypes and stuff. Yeah. I mean, you're just all the work that you're doing is incredible. Thank you so much. I love it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I kind of feel like I can't, this is work that I have to do. I'm called to do it.
So yes.
It's my assignment in this life.
So I have one last question for you that I ask all of my guests. And it is, what did you used to believe was forbidden in your life that now you enjoy freely?
Ooh, let's see. Just telling it like it is, honestly. Telling it like it is. I think, I have been in many situations where I felt like my well-being was dependent on my ability to maintain the story, whatever that story was, and I don't do that shit anymore.
Nice.
So authenticity, I guess you could say.
I love it. Thank you so much, Amy. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Melissa. It's been great.
Been listening to Loving the F. I'm Melissa Allison, and I hope you'll join me again next week.